Fearscape Media Network. Exploring the unknown, one podcast at a time.
Fearscape Paranormal Podcast, part of the Fearscape Media Network. Prepare to be spooked. New episodes every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms. Find out more at fearscapepodcast.com.
Welcome, everyone, to Unsensitive, a show where we take a subject, talk with an expert, and break it down with questions that maybe are normally too impolite to ask. I am your host, Ray Robinson, and today we're going to be looking at living abroad, things that you may not have a thorough knowledge about, things that you might think you know, but you should know a little bit more about, and other misconceptions, especially since our guest is currently in Iceland. We're going to be talking about misconceptions about that country as well. So joining us today is Heather Catherine Allens. Allens-Dottir, right?
That's
perfect.
Great.
Well, Heather, so welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for having me.
So now let's just kind of start with how you found yourself in Iceland. What's the story that got you there from where you're from?
From where I'm from. Well, I'm not from... I'm from somewhere not very far from Iceland. I'm just down south in the UK. Mm-hmm. Iceland is direct north of it, but I managed to kind of take in about five continents before I wound up here. So the long story short is I study constitution, which is a very handy way to travel because pretty much every country has one, except ironically... the UK, which famously doesn't have a constitution. I guess it's kind of embarrassing being an academic of constitutions and being from the UK. It's kind of like being an expert in like soccer from like the US. Everyone's like, why do you do this thing that everyone else in the world does? Mm-hmm. So the long story short is Iceland had this super fascinating constitution drafting process in the aftermath of the global financial crisis in 2008, where they had basically a revolution, but in a very cute, quiet, Nordic way, where nobody like got hurt. They just went out on the streets and said, can the government please leave? And the government left. And then they had this super cool Icelandic constitution drafting process. So I came here just over a year ago to start studying that. And it's been amazing. It's been very, very cool. And prior to that, I was living in Australia. Prior to that, I was living in Israel. Prior to that, I was living in Russia. And the years of the Arab revolutions, I was sort of 2011 to 2014, I was living mainly in Tunisia and in Egypt. So the whole time that Iceland was having this super cool, inclusive, like Nordic utopia, like feminist, LGBT friendly constitution drafting process, I was in the Middle East, like running away from like tanks in Tahrir Square.
Wow.
So like coming here and they were like, we had a revolution too. I'm like, I would have had a lot calmer time if I'd come here in 2011.
Yes.
But, you know, better late than never.
Now, since you travel a lot, I'm sure the first question a lot of folks ask here, do you get homesick?
That's a great question. So I say this with no judgment to anyone else's experience to talk about my experience. I don't get homesick because for me, family and a sense of belonging isn't a specific place. I miss my family a lot. That's probably a better way to put it. I'm very close to my family, but my sense of belonging isn't kind of bounded to a place. So as long as I can talk to the people I love, it doesn't really matter where I am and where they are, because I don't have a sense of, I have to be back in my childhood home. I moved around a lot growing up, and I think that that's something that affects one's desire to travel a lot as an adult. So I was born in Australia. We left when I was five. And we moved to London in 1990, and everyone called me Kylie for a year because of my accent. And I just lost the accent. It was 1990. I just lost the accent when our family moved again. My father's from Liverpool, originally from Merseyside. We moved up there and I got an accent like this, like, you know, like I'm talking like John Lennon. Whereupon we moved down south to very like leafy, Gentile, middle-class Cambridge. And they just like teased me mercilessly until I lost that accent. So my childhood was basically a tour of like all the terrible accents of the Anglophone world until we got to Cambridge and they basically like My Fair Lady'd me and like put marbles in my mouth. So we stopped talking like that all the time. Yeah.
You haven't by chance mastered the Southern America accent, have you? The various y'alls.
I was in a production of A Streetcar Named Desire as a teenager, but I'm not going to subject your audience to that. So I do love doing accents, though. That is one of my all-time favorite activities in the world. Yeah.
Excellent. Now, in your travels, you had mentioned that you had been kind of running from tanks at one point, which I found interesting. Have you ever been in a moment of danger that you felt like, there's really no safety net for me to get my way out of this? Has that ever been a really big concern for you in your travels?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I guess there's a kind of silly answer to it. I have some funny stories. And the more serious answer that, yes, when I was younger, I think I didn't have the sense of care that I probably should have. And that also I'm very aware of my privilege, right? I'm a white person with a British passport. And so like, I want to like honor and respect the experiences of people who were, you know, in the Egyptian Revolution, some of whom were my closest friends. And that's what I wrote my PhD on. So, you know, I do have some great stories from the revolution, but it was also a very difficult time. Having said that, like being the very complex power and powerlessness bound together of being a foreign woman is something that's always been complex. And like, there's this big debate because I read a lot of travel writing and I read a lot of travel writing by women, even though I would identify as like a writer who has traveled a lot. I don't consider my writing travel writing, but there's this big kind of tension with like female people identify as women who write about travel, like whether or not we should talk about our gender, right? Like, because there's a sort of like, well, why do we have to make that, you know, is if we acknowledge it, are we making male a default? But on the other hand, you know, you move through a gendered world and the way that people respond to you is based on your gender. And I have all these sort of passports and golden tickets that open doors for me totally unfairly because of global power dynamics and the colonial legacy that I don't endorse at all and often make me very uncomfortable. Or these are, or also the kind of the combination of being treated like half like a princess, half like a waitress, like people like not knowing how to place you, like your gender plus your passport. So yeah, I think that's very complex. The thing that I think is hardest about travel is not physical danger or physical safety, it's the feeling of becoming unmoored, like psychologically unmoored, or like losing your anchor, losing your reference point as you kind of go into a different culture. Like the thing that I found most traumatic in all my travels wasn't like the physical violence that I experienced or witnessed at kind of flashpoints of revolution. It was when I lived in Russia and I got very, very, I could no longer tell what was kind of a bit of a woo-woo thought and what was like an actually true thought, because I was there in 2015 at the height of the tensions between Russia and the West. And so all my friends joking, haha, they're probably listening in on your phone calls. And then my colleagues at my like law faculty at the University of Moscow going like, but you know, they're listening in on your phone calls, right? So that kind of like how it warps your sense of self, that was much more like disorientating than the sort of the adrenaline rush of a flash moment of violence. And that's how authoritarianism can be so like corrosive. Yeah.
Now, since you do a lot of travel, you're I'm sure always at some point anyway, surrounded by people that speak different languages than you. A lot of us probably don't know that feeling if we don't travel too much, but how difficult is it when you're the only person that speaks your language and you're surrounded by folks that are speaking their native tongue and you have no idea necessarily what they're talking about?
Well, my years in improv comedy served me really well because I'm excellent at mime. That's yeah. Very, very good. Like, I need a can opener. I can, you know, I can act that out in Ukrainian. In all seriousness, well, firstly, again, like to acknowledge my privilege, I speak the language that's the global lingua franca as my native tongue by, you know, like virtue of all sorts of terrible historical reasons. So I'm very lucky that mostly when I go somewhere, there will be someone who speaks English. So I'm not someone who has traveled a lot. If Albanian was my native language and then I had spent time in all these other countries, that would be a different dynamic and much more impressive. Like, I'm always amazed when I meet, for instance, foreign correspondents from other countries who are like often writing in a third or fourth language. And then the second thing is that it's actually very easy and very sad, and I would warn against this, to fall into your little bubble of expats and just like live. And it took me a long time to learn how to not do that. Like when I first moved to Jordan in my early 20s, and there was this sort of like, I mean, I would now be like incredibly critical of it, but like the sort of the NGO, Western NGO bubble, and we all lived, there was this like neighborhood that we lived in, and you could like, you could kind of travel through those kind of tram lines of the city very easily. But to then more directly answer your question, it is challenging, but it's also the best way to learn a language, right? To immerse yourself in it. Mm-hmm. And at first it does feel like you're walking underwater the whole time, or like feeling the world through rubber gloves, or you want to go around carrying a sign saying, I'm not stupid, I'm just bad at your language, because that frustration that like you can't convey, I need a tin opener, you'd be like, you want to say like, I promise I'm really eloquent in my native tongue. But then it's, that's why, and like, I don't mean to be all kind of like cliche and hippie about this, but that's why travel is so amazing, because it gives you empathy, right? So I hope that, you know, if somebody has that experience, that when they go back to their own country and they meet like a recently arrived immigrant who's struggling with English, they think, okay, well, how good is my Hindi or Portuguese or Spanish, or, you know, like, you know, to have empathy for what situation they're in.
Right. Yeah. Now, you've mentioned that you've been in Iceland for over just about a year, over a year now. So you probably, unless you've had to leave for periods of time, have you had any dealing with traveling with the COVID-19 virus being so prevalent, or has that not been an issue for you yet, and you're looking forward to when that becomes an issue for you?
I'm so lucky, to the point I actually have like all sorts of guilt, all my guilt going out, that Iceland was one of the success. So I was in London to try to tidy up some actually weird hangover of my PhD that hiccuped back into my life, of like things I wrote about the Egyptian revolution that then got into the hands of people they shouldn't get into the hands of. So I was in London the day before like the world fell, like froze, like March 8th, and I caught the last plane back to Iceland and waited it out here. And Iceland was one of the global sort of success stories alongside New Zealand for COVID. So I'm very, very lucky to have been here. My little sister's an epidemiologist in London, so I know how grim it's been in so many places. The other thing, and again, like I'm being flippant, but I want to acknowledge that the tragedy that so many people have had in 2020, it's been a really tough year. But like on a light note, it's really hard for me to be in a country where I'm not in like antagonistic opposition to the government, because like Katrin Jakobsdottir, I have no affiliation with her. I'm not like shilling for her, but she's very akin to like Jacinda Ardern. And in fact, there are lots of really interesting Icelandic New Zealand parallels. She's this cool like female prime minister, and she seems to like be able to like read a policy paper and then like make decisions based on evidence that will like help people as a whole, which is really like the bare minimum we should ask of politicians. But in 2020, like the bar is so like she's not tweeting that we should drink bleach. She's not like, you know, like it's like really weird, as you know, like my teenage anarchist self is like bristling. I'm like, I respect the prime minister and think she makes good decisions for the good of all of us. It's a struggle.
Yeah.
Not to make light of 2020, of course.
Yes. Yeah. Now, let's delve a little bit more into Iceland itself. You've really developed a love of the country over the last year. I always want to kind of work on some of the misconceptions, but actually, let's just start out first with you just kind of giving your general overall impression of the country from an outsider's point of view.
Sure. Yeah, I'd love to. I want to caveat first, like, I'm not paid to promote Iceland, because sound so effusive that people might think that I'm just chilling for it. No, I've just drunk the Kool-Aid, basically. I always thought I would love it. I've always, like, when I was young, I loved the Philip Pullman Northern Lights trilogy. I think they got the Amber Spyglass in the States. Mm-hmm. and with like Lyra going up to see the Northern Lights. So I was always fascinated by the Northern Lights. I always wanted to see the Northern Lights. And then as someone, you know, I spent a lot of the 2010s working on climate issues and gender equality. And Iceland always comes top of the list globally as like the best place in the world to be a woman. It's also the greenest country in the world, and it's also the safest country in the world. So after some of my traumas in less Nordic utopic places, it's been very good kind of mental sorbet in that way. It's also that it's just it like everywhere is unique, and you don't want to perpetuate kind of like cliches of anywhere, but some Iceland is more unique than all the other, you know, it's the only country in the world on two tectonic plates, the landmass. So it's half in Europe, half in North America, and you can literally walk the ridge, which is really fascinating. And then the other like cliche, but it's true, is that it's a land of fire and ice, like the volcanoes and the glaciers. I literally live between a volcano and a glacier. And when I turned up, the first thing I asked was, how dormant is it? And they said, very dormant. And I was like, can you please break down the concept of dormant to me very, very specifically? They were like, it hasn't gone off in 10,000 years. So I was like, is it on a 10,000 year cycle? Like, no. So I'm good. Although the one up the road, the one that suspended global travel in 2009, mm-hmm. word on the street is 2021, that's popping off again. Which is great because, you know, we haven't had any big major global crises recently. So, yeah, that's immense global travel. Yeah, that's chill.
Now, you had mentioned that it's a land of fire and ice. The name Iceland automatically makes people think it's frozen. And we also, there's people out there that say, well, Greenland is covered with ice, but Iceland is covered with green. Right. How accurate are both of those statements?
I've never been to Greenland, but I would love to go. I was meant, again, with all the tragedy in 2020, I can't play too much. I was meant to go this year, and I was looking forward to it so much. I was reading up so much about Greenlandic culture, and I've never been to Greenland. But Iceland, it is snowy for like 4 months of the year. I mean, we had a blizzard today. But it is very lush. One thing that really strikes me, for like a relatively small island, I mean, it feels like about the size of Ireland, it's very geologically diverse, which is really fascinating. Like if I go like 10 miles up the road, I feel like I'm in a different country because it's no longer like volcanic, it's no longer like lava fields, and it's these rolling plains and that kind of thing. But it's just to encourage people to come here, like if they're considering coming to Iceland but they're worried that it's going to be cold, this summer is like, it's sort of bright blue skies, and you have the white nights in July where like the sun doesn't set or barely sets, and it's very like balmy, and it's lovely. It's really, really lovely. So no, it's not like frozen tundra wasteland 12 months a year.
Gotcha. I didn't personally know a whole lot of rumors, misconceptions about Iceland. Right. So I looked online and found some of the weirdest things that people believe.
Sure you did.
I tell you, the one that kind of stuck out to me is that that people believe that Icelanders' primary diet is fermented shark and whale blubber. Which, number one, tells me, I was like, how many sharks are in the area that they have time to ferment them? but and also, is that real? Is that, have you been to a restaurant where that's like all they got on the menu or anything?
I'm an outsider here, and I don't want to perpetuate, you know, I don't want to like annoy any Icelandic people, because I'm also like, have been anchored here enough to know. But I mean, fermented shark is real. And it's hard to tell now to what extent that's a self-perpetuation of like the tourist walking up saying, hey, can you try that fermented shark? But you're meant to drink it with this thing called brandvin, which is literally called the Black Death. So, I mean, it's like the whole, like, it's a very, like, steampunk vibe, like, yes. My shark meat, my Black Death. This sort of hardcore Viking vibe that they've got going on. It is really hard to eat when your land is covered in snow for a long time. You know, Canadians have this issue. Those of Northern Slavic people had this issue. So sometimes they would bury things in the ground and then dig them up 4 months later and have a chomp, and clearly it worked out.
Have you personally ever partaken of fermented shark or whale blubber?
I had actually tried both. Yeah. Oh, okay. It was very chewy. Yeah. But also, like, the fisher is super delicious. Like, there's a salmon river, like, just like up the road from me, and the salmon here is super delicious. So I tell myself I'm getting, like, really good brain food from all that, like, omega. Yeah.
Excellent. I tell you another fun rumor that came up that got my attention. I wanted to find out if, I'm almost certain there's no accuracy to this at all, but one of the perpetuating myths is that the Icelandic government will pay men to come and marry Icelandic women.
I've heard this rumor as well. No, that one's not true.
That seems like an awful interesting use of resources.
that one is definitely not true. I think it's the joke that this, the country's so small, like 350,000 people, which is tiny, right? It's really, really small. And so the joke needed that they need kind of like a bit of an injection of genetic diversity is the joke, right? Mm. No, I think that's not true, and not very in keep. But I mean, the policies of the Icelandic government in terms of gender issues are like brilliant. So I'm pretty sure they're not selling their women folk off to the highest bidder. like, I don't think Katrin Jakobsdottir would be down with that. The one, I don't know if you came across this one in the kind of, and again, like, I have this tension here, like, I'm not from here and I don't want to perpetuate stereotype, but then I also know what people say about Iceland and I am still a bit of an outsider here. There's the joke that there's an app to check that you're not dating your cousin.
Mm-hmm. I've heard about
have
that.
Have you heard of that? Yeah. So yeah. That one actually is more true. It's to do with, they have their, like, the, in Britain, we have the Doomsday Book, like, that was written in the medieval period, everyone's, you know, name. And then the tree, well, they just kept writing it down and they just have the sagas and no one kind of really came or went that much for a long time. Actually, that's not true. There were sailors rocked up and left, Basque sailors, Irish sailors. I'm from a family of sailors, so I'm not saying anything about sailors or having a girl in every port or anything along those lines. They just carried on with you. So you can, the question between two Icelandic people is not, are we related? But it's how far back are we related? As I've sat with my friends, like in the bar sometimes, and they say, oh, so it was your cousin to that cousin to that cousin. And they can kind of map out everyone in that manner. It's very, very cool. Interesting development here is that 2 years ago, they're my friends, this lovely couple moved here. I was going to say a rabbi, but he's also the rabbi because he's the only rabbi. So I'm friends with the chief rabbi, which in most countries sounds really, really name dropping. But here it's just like Avi up the road because like everyone knows because he's the only rabbi in the village. And that's been like a really amazing development in Iceland to have like that. That cultural influence as well, like I, because of my time in Israel, I go there and like practice my Hebrew, and that's been really, really lovely. And I think they felt like very welcome. So I also don't want to perpetuate the stereotype that it's super like monotone here. Like there is sort of really interesting stuff happening. And it's been really amazing to see them create this like this Jewish center, which has been very cool. And also like the threads of that, like there's a medieval saga. Icelandic saga about like in a positive way about like Jewish people. So there's all these like old threads that they're picking up. And what's really lovely about here is that mix of like the pre-modern, you know, like all the sagas and all these old beautiful traditions, and that it's like really modern in like the best way in terms of like it's a very good place to like be a woman or for LGBT rights and that kind of thing. So that's really lovely.
And there was one other thing that depending on which resource that I looked at, some said that that there aren't as many Viking descendants as one would think. And there's some that, resources that say there's a lot. Is that something that the Icelandic government itself has kind of promoted, because there's been a lot of resurgence in popularity from shows like Vikings, Game of Thrones. Have they kind of been pushing that a little bit, maybe to up the tourism factor?
Yeah, I don't know on the level of efficient government policy. And mm-hmm. I want to reiterate again, just because I sound like such a fangirl for Iceland, like I have no affiliation to the government. Like I'm shilling on my own. but on the level of tourism, like in downtown Reykjavik, you can see they're very much like tapping into that, those tropes. And certainly, like, I do feel that Game of Thrones has been like a big influence. They kind of know that that's what tourists want and then kind of like gear it towards that. And then I think with Viking, the one thing that I sort of didn't really know until I came here was that like to Viking was a verb. It just meant to kind of like to go out and to go. It's like I knew the Vikings as a you know British schoolgirl as you know we'd go to York, like the Jorvik, which was the Viking town in Northern England. So I knew them from like from the other side, like the Vikings who had arrived and the legacy they left on the British Isles. So I think whether like the boundary of what constitutes a Viking is probably in itself up for debate. And that's why there's that tension about what answer there is. On the other hand, like an Icelandic guy in a bar after a few drinks seems to be very willing to tell you how much of a big, tough Viking they are. There's certainly a trope they like to draw upon.
Well, if it's popular, keep working it. That's what I always say.
That's their winning formula.
Is there anything that that we hadn't really covered that you think really ought to be mentioned about Iceland in particular?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think it may sound cliche, but the Northern Lights are unlike anything in the world. I if you haven't seen them, I would say please try seeing them. The first time I saw them, I thought that I was having like an epileptic fit or something because I didn't know. They were like, when they're so, like green, and the way that they bounce across the sky, it's really astonishing. It's really like been like such a kind of marvel, such a wonder. Like it's actually made me want to like study these things because it's really incredible. And the other thing I think I would just say is how like welcoming Icelandic people are and how keen Icelandic people I have found have been to people taking like if they're a kind of open-hearted interest in their culture. Like we have these big conversations and they're big debates about, you know, issues to do with cultural appropriation and cultural sensitivity, and I'm very kind of cognizant of that. Like I had this whole issue with like changing my name to do with Icelandic naming law. A very funny dynamic whereby all my like super woke like Guardian writer friends in London were saying they're going be really offended you're appropriating our culture, and all my Icelandic friends were like, we love it, this is super cool. So that was kind of funny. I don't want to kind of like it seemed like I'm kind of like fetishizing Iceland like kind of in a objectifying way. But one thing that's really one, and probably because it's such a small nation, like, you know, it's like a big village. They've been so like excited and welcoming to people taking an interest in Iceland, which is really lovely. When this Will Ferrell Eurovision film came out earlier this year. And again, I think there were these which are valid discussions, and we should be having them in general about, you know, cultural appropriation. Icelandic people were almost a bit like offended that people were offended. They were like, no, you're all singing about Húsavík. That's like up the road. My cousin, like Bjarni, lives there, and it's his cool place. Now you will know it too, and that's super cool. You know, like their spirits seem to be, in general, more like you made a Mamma Mia about us. We love that. And so I think that that's one thing I would say that Iceland is a really great place to get to know, because Icelandic people want other people to get to know it. And that's like really lovely.
Wonderful. Well, Heather, thank you so much for taking some time and telling us a little bit about your travels, about travel in general, and specifically about Iceland. It's I learned a few things, and I think we dispelled a few of the weird rumors that float around out there. And so thank you so much. It's been really fun and entertaining.
It's been lovely. Thank you so much for inviting me. Thank
Absolutely.
You again.
And now a challenge to our listeners, as I do every week. If you have a subject that you're also passionate about, like Heather here, and you can speak with authority on that subject, and you're not afraid to tackle some tough questions that might come your way, then I want to talk to you here on Unsensitive. So reach out through the Fearscape Media Network, or reach out to me directly at rayrobwrites@gmail.com, and maybe you'll be the next one I'm talking to. A special thanks to Ben Sounds for the use of the song Happy Rock, and of course the fine folks at Fearscape for giving me a venue here. Thank you again for listening to Unsensitive. We'll talk again soon, and until then, keep your mind open.